Hello and welcome. My name is Oshan Rees and I'm delighted to be joined by two Investec colleagues, namely Nicola Mallard, who is a senior research analyst with over 30 years of research experience covering the consumer sector, and Victoria Clark from Investec's economics team and formerly a senior economic advisor to the Cabinet Office. Today, we're here to talk about the food and drink sector, which has been tested severely by the coronavirus outbreak, with supply shortages, changing consumer demand and staffing issues wreaking havoc across the industry. We're now almost 8 weeks into the UK lockdown, and although we're a long way from things being back to normal, it does seem that, relatively speaking at least, things are starting to stabilise, meaning we can start to take a clearer look at the current situation and what we might expect to see from the near future. With that in mind, if I can begin with you, Nicola, it feels as though the worst of the shortages that made life difficult for retailers are behind us. Is that accurate? And how are the listed food companies doing at this point?
Yes, thanks, Oshan. It's quite an interesting debate. But from my own shopping experiences, I'd say that it would appear that the shortages are easing. Although they probably weren't actually due to issues with the manufacturers in the first place. It's more likely that the sudden spikes in demand that we saw for certain products, normally these have very predictable sales patterns, and they would have been hard to accommodate in a supply chain, which quite frankly over the years has been fine-tuned to run on a just-in-time basis. Also in the early weeks, I think there were some stresses around the availability of drivers in the logistics side as well. The companies that I've been in touch with are generally reporting more manageable levels of absenteeism now. There's been some reduction in the number of people off work in recent weeks, so that's helping. Clearly, some of them are seeing still strong demand. So the problem or the issue for them, nice issue to have, is to try and to keep pace with that strong surge in sales. And they do seem to be managing largely. So certainly we haven't seen any issues like we've seen in the US, where certain factories have been forced to close because they've had over 25% of the staff off with illness.
It's fascinating. I can't profess to go to the supermarket more than I need to these days, so I can't comment on specific items, but it certainly seems to be the case that what you've just described is entirely accurate. Turning to the supply chain in the food and drink sector, how has that changed and how much of that is here to stay perhaps?
Well, I think the main change, I suppose, is the switch in volumes that we've seen between food service and home consumption. Obviously, with lockdown, we're not going anywhere, so we're all sitting at home and eating more. But for some manufacturers that service both channels, that clearly presents quite a challenge. They have the product there, but what they're finding probably is in the wrong format. So they are having to repackage from bulk down into smaller consumer sizes. And that's been one of the issues reported, for example, by the flour millers. However, what's more often the case is that those two supply channels actually have different supply chains. So whilst we are seeing some companies trying to keep pace with strong demand, as I mentioned before, others have actually seen their sales dry up overnight. So that's been more of an issue. You'll have seen reports, obviously, in the press about milk farmers. You know, those selling to the retailers have been fine, and their market's still undoubtedly there. But those selling into the food service area, you know, they're pouring milk away, which is a dreadful waste. I think as the hospitality trade reopens, then clearly we'll start to see that switch back. There is a question as to how much of the hospitality trade will actually reopen and how many businesses may have failed in this sort of lockdown period. One other change we've seen, obviously, is range simplification. So we've seen a lot of companies talk about this. About a third of people say that they've had their range or some range is reduced by the retail customers. This is actually helping, though, because from a production schedule, if you have a lot of products that you're trying to make on a daily basis, there's a lot of stop-start production, and that's time-wasting. So if you can reduce the amount of products you're making on a daily basis, then clearly you can do longer production runs, and it does make life easier. And it's also easier for the retailers to replenish the shelves as well. So that's why we're probably not seeing quite so many stock outages as we're going around the stores, but we are seeing a reduced range of products. It's less clear cut to see how many of those lines will return. I mean, I suppose if there's consumers demand and they keep asking for it, then there's a chance that we will get some of those ranges back. The other thing as well, probably worth mentioning, is own label. So obviously, when that panic buying set in, people's favourite brands probably sold out first. And consumers have been, wanting the product still, so they've picked up the own label equivalent. And I think if it's proving that some of these products are largely indistinguishable from the brand, then they may well stay in people's shopping baskets going forward because they're normally quite a bit less expensive.
Fascinating patterns developing clearly, and interesting to have them highlighted perhaps in the way you've described them. Thank you for that. With regards to perhaps some of the larger retailers as well, are we seeing any evidence of how they're perhaps protecting the longevity of their supply chain? Because I'm sure that people's working capital flows have changed materially over the last few months. Is that something you've come across?
We haven't had any incidences where the manufacturers are saying that they've been specifically helped by the retailers. I mean, we do deal mostly with the larger companies in terms of the listed PLCs. They tend not to be, the very small mom and pop type businesses. So by and large, I think they're probably relatively sound in terms of their finances and their working capital. So we haven't had any companies report that back to us.
That's it's something I guess that we'll keep an eye on over the coming months, because I think that there's evidence in some other sectors of people trying or large companies trying to protect the longevity of their supply chain, but clearly not affected the food chain yet. Thank you. What food and drink categories are proving to be winners and losers, and how might that change as lockdown eases? You've talked about brand and so forth. Are there any others?
Well, I suppose by category, I mean, rather than brand versus own label, the Kantar data is saying that weekly sales for food and drink is up by at least 10%, and in some weeks it's been up by over 20%. Now, we've had some unusual weeks clearly in the last month. So we've had Easter, we've had bank holiday, we've had the VE Day celebrations, and we've had some very good weather, and all of these can influence what people do with their shopping baskets. So we're still waiting to see where all this settles out. None of the companies would suggest that, a 20% increase on a weekly basis is the new norm. But the lines that have been particularly popular really have been the longer shelf life products. So we are all out there, as you said, Ocean yourself, shopping less frequently. So frozen, tinned, and the ambient type products like rice and pasta have been especially popular. Protein, which is the centre of most meals, is also strongly ahead, and particularly the versatile products such as chicken and mince, where people can buy those products and then make a variety of different meals when they get home. Alcohol, certainly through retail, the anecdotal evidence says we are all actually drinking more at home. Clearly, that for alcohol businesses, that their sales in the off trade have disappeared overnight, so they won't necessarily be sort of up overall. Cleaning and washing products also been a winner, and that's been a category that over the last sort of 3 or 4 years has been particularly challenging for these businesses. I mean, it would appear that we're all either cleaning our house or washing our clothes less frequently, but I think we're just getting clever in terms of the usage of these products and making them last longer. But that's certainly reversed in the last couple of weeks. The losers, I guess, really short shelf life products. So what would have been the food of today, going back with the sort of the chilled food categories, which have been strong growth areas, because they're sort of made today for eating tomorrow, they've really fallen in popularity. And also items that you'd eat on the go, sandwiches and those sort of products, we're not on the go anymore, so sales are down there. And non-essential foods, so things like cakes and desserts, probably not the first thing you'd grab as you go in the supermarket if you want to be in and out of there fairly quickly.
Just talking about perhaps one of the things that you've touched upon there, we've seen some big shifts back towards food staples, away from newer shopping trends that have emerged. Is it perhaps an influence of us all growing our own veg and baking our own bread a little bit more? And perhaps should producers be worried?
Well, I think people have sort of shown an aptitude to start cooking from scratch again. That was already probably a trend anyway, because you've probably seen the growth of these meal kits. You know, people have talked about HelloFresh and Gusto. Now, they've clearly had a fantastic opportunity with the lockdown period to further their customer base. But those were already a big growth area, which shows that people were interested in cooking from scratch. I mean, those kits obviously provide you everything, all the ingredients in one box. So that's an interesting question. I mean, I think the one thing, though, that we have on our side right now is time. So we're all sitting at home, you know, we're working from home still, so I don't necessarily have that much time. But a lot of people who have been furloughed are sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? So, you know, going out in the garden and doing some gardening or baking a loaf, which takes you 3 hours, is something nice. That will change, unfortunately, when we all go back to work. You know, time will become one of those precious commodities. So I think some of that will wane. But clearly, unless people have discovered a new hobby and they want to keep baking their own bread or growing their courgettes, then maybe there'll be a you know, an element of that will stick with us. But I think people will also really still crave variety, and unless you're a very good cook and you fancy doing Mexican one night, you know, sort of Indian cuisine another, and Chinese the night after that, then we will probably see a trend back to some of the prepared foods that have been growth areas in the past.
I can't profess to being a professional cook, and perhaps I'm one of those people that will very quickly fall into that latter category. Thank you, Nicola. Victoria, if I can turn to you and ask you to give an economic insight into what's happening. It sounds as though we're still a long way from even a partial reopening of hospitality businesses. Can you talk us through how a phased return might work for these companies?
Yeah, I think that's right. Unfortunately, we are, you know, still a long way from normality, or perhaps a new normal, you know, for quite a lot of the economy. So, what we've started to see from the government is a bit of detail on the plan. And earlier this week, Boris Johnson and his colleagues have set out this three-phase approach. So we're moving into this kind of secondary phase of smarter controls, which is where they'll start to gradually replace some of those social restrictions with what they're talking about being kind of smarter measures. And then after that, there's this third phase where they're saying, well, once we've got a reliable treatment or perhaps a reliable vaccine, then we can encourage this bigger return to work. And for hospitality, from the government's advice that we had earlier this week, food service providers, pubs, accommodation, etc., they're all within this step three of the plan. And at the moment, the government's guidance is that that's going to be taken no earlier than 4th of July. So, as you say, it looks as if we're still quite a long way from that happening. And all of this is still subject to, you know, this reinfection rate that we've heard a lot about. So, as they start to move into this new phase of reopening the economy, how are cases and the reinfection rate developing? And obviously, if that picks up again and the social distancing that's being deployed at the moment creates a second spike in cases, then this could all be pushed back much further. And, you know, for these businesses, for hospitality, obviously what is possible is going to depend on how this first phase goes, how social distancing works, you know, whether they've got facilities for indoor or outdoor capabilities. We've heard quite a lot about that, and whether they can reopen with, say, you know, takeout facilities or add to those in the meantime. So there's a lot of different variants to this. And I think, you know, even with the guidance that we've had so far being relatively detailed, there's still a lot of unanswered questions, and much of it is going to depend on the science and the medical evolution of the data. And there may be other factors which, you know, complicate the picture for reopening. You know, will people be scarred by the experience that they've had? You know, if office workers, say, aren't returning to the big cities for much longer than, say, even the return to the phase three of the reopening, then will that affect their market? So they might then be able to reopen, but perhaps the people won't be there to flock to the businesses. So there's a lot of questions still, but as I say, as you say, it's still quite a long way back, and it looks as if the government's going to do some pilot reopenings and run some task force just to see how it might all work. So I don't think we'll have real clarity on it for, you know, who knows, but perhaps another month or two.
Clearly a number of factors at play, and as you say, let's hope it becomes a little bit clearer for everybody over the next couple of weeks. Turning, if I may, to the supply side of things, there's been talk of difficulties getting access to enough workers to pick British fruits over the harvest season, and the recently announced 14-day quarantine probably makes matters worse. Is it reasonable to expect that workers already in the UK will pick up the slack? If not, does the government have any ideas up its sleeve?
Yeah, these stories have really caught my attention, actually. It's very interesting to see how, when we've got now probably a quarter of the UK workforce on furlough, that's more than 7 million people, I think 1.8 million on universal credit in the week from 16th of March to the 28th, in the period from the 16th of March to the 28th of April, how then you've got these reports of shortages in particular segments. And as you say, one key one has been fruit pickers. And there's been a lot written on this. So you've got this Pick for Britain recruitment drive where they've been trying to kind of run on the wartime spirit, saying, let's get British workers in to fill some of these jobs. And there was a report in the Financial Times, I think in late April, saying after they did a big recruitment drive through this agency, they only managed to get 150 people to take these jobs from 50,000 expressions of interest. So clearly there's quite an issue here. And everybody's been, you know, the government and the recruitment agents have been racking their brains trying to work out kind of what the issue is, given what I've said about the scale of the potential labour pool. And it's interesting to note that it's not just a British issue. So you've got apparently 200,000 vacancies in France, 80,000 in Spain, 250,000 in Italy. So this is going on across Europe, where we, got lots and lots of people on various domestic or international versions of kind of unemployment insurance and not finding people for work in other sectors. And what seems to be coming through from the investigations that the government's done from the agencies is that there are kind of a mismatch of things going on various fronts. One seems to be that it's extremely hard physical work. So there might be a lot of people in that labour pool who perhaps aren't suited to doing it from that perspective. Skills, it's highly skilled in some respects, because farmers are saying that they need people who can recognize which fruit to pick at which time, and make sure that you can mesh that experience together with the physicality of it. That might be quite difficult to do. The farms might be too far from home. There's obviously a possible question about pay rates and whether that's appealing to people. But the other thing that's links into what the government's doing on its initiatives is the furlough, and just some questions there as to whether perhaps people, given those circumstances, are just thinking, actually, if I can continue on furlough for my existing organisation, that might be a more appealing situation than having to go out there and retrain and gain these skills and do this very physical work. There's a question. I don't intend to answer it, but whether we can expect them to pick up the slack. Well, clearly the indication is that that's not happening. And I think the government's sort of back pocket plan, at least from what we've seen so far, is that it's reportedly got some charter flights and it's bringing in workers. I think it flew some in from Bucharest, according to various news reports, and Berlin's been doing similar things. So it does appear that there's a mismatch of skills, a mismatch of geography issues, and also perhaps on pay rates as well. That's just not delivering what workers are looking for.
Fascinating. Does it feel like the government is therefore doing enough to help the food and drink industry, Victoria?
Well, I mean, clearly they're up against it, as you can see from the economy figures. I mean, we had GDP figures just for March this morning, and March saw pretty much 1 week, a little bit more than 1 week of lockdown, and the economy overall is suffering hugely. But one of the worst affected sectors is, clearly food and drink. And there are a whole host of government initiatives. We've had our work cut out just trying to track them as they get announced, with a new one each day and a new tweak to each initiative as the government tries to work out where those big holes and pressure points are. But food and drink, hospitality is really one of the worst. Hospitality in particular is one of the worst affected sectors in the main. Now, the government is trying to balance this out, right? So it realizes that it needs to stop otherwise good businesses going under amidst what should be a short-term pressure. But at the same time, it's got this huge fiscal pressure now. You know, borrowing this year is reportedly going to be above £300 billion, and now the government's trying to work out what tax rises and spending cuts it might need to do to bring some of that in. So it wants to put the right support in to keep those otherwise good businesses going, but it doesn't want to make it so generous that it creates itself a fiscal problem and otherwise keep those perhaps less favourable businesses going, where eventually they might, you know, not make it through this period of turmoil anyway. So there's quite a lot out there. I mean, as I say, there's a lot of initiatives. You've got deferral of VAT payments, business rates. There's two grant funding schemes, one particularly for retail, hospitality and leisure. So there are a lot of things out there. There's lots of loan programs for small businesses. But the message that seems to come through, particularly from UK hospitality, is that the government policy is falling short in a few areas, and some may say more. You know, there's things like delays in loans being reported. The coronavirus job retention scheme has some particular issues for hospitality because, you know, if you're a seasonal worker or you haven't got a payslip, perhaps it might be more difficult to show your eligibility for those sorts of support nets. And I believe that the 3-week minimum for access to the furlough scheme has also created some issues because, you know, if you're looking to hire someone on a very short term basis, that's problematic. And a lot of those very focused local government grants are for the smaller businesses. So there's those sorts of size of business, making sure that the right sort of support is available for the right sorts of businesses. So, you know, I'm sure the government hasn't got it perfectly right, as it hasn't for most of these initiatives. But, you know, one thing we've been saying is just the key thing about this whole episode is the unprecedented speed with which this economic shock arrived. And, you know, the government is just scrambling around trying to plug holes as quickly as it can. So it probably hasn't done it perfectly. It probably does need to do more, particularly given what we were saying a few moments ago about the extent to which hospitality is going to be affected for quite a lot longer than some of the other UK sectors. So I, you know, in short, I'd expect to see more, and the government will, you know, will continue to look at what tweaks and adjustments and perhaps new measures need to be put in place as it moves through its phases of its lockdown exit.
Plenty for us to keep an eye on, I'm sure. Nicola, Victoria, I'm going to close this podcast by thanking you very much for sharing many thought-provoking and interesting points. We're clearly living a fast-changing world, and this, like many other sectors, the food and drink sector, will need to evolve quickly in line with those changes. I'd also like to thank our audience and those who choose to listen to this podcast. I hope you find it as interesting as we have to record it. Many thanks.